Book of Daniel, chapter 9. We already had one good thing happen this week. Last week I went to Bournemouth, where I act like a gallant every single day. And I got in the scarves today to find out that I've only put on 4 pounds. I once put on a whole stone. So that was good news. Okay, today we're going to continue to look at the future. And in my last talks on the Great Tribulation, we're going to look at a chronological sequence of events, particularly in the life of the Antichrist. One lady once used to come to a once-a-month Bible study group that I used to do. Also, you used to go to a once-a-month meetings at Ashvale on end times. And she said to me one day, "Can you tell me the chronological sequence of end-time events?" Despite all the teaching she'd had on it, she was still confused on the subject. Many people are. Daniel 9 is a very interesting subject because a lot of people don't really understand a lot of what is going on in this passage. It starts off by saying, "In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans." The Chaldeans is an ancient name for the Babylonians. "This year was the year 539. No one has ever found any history about Darius the Mede." He's the same guy who had Daniel Frank in the 10th line. But they do believe that he's actually a person who was called Ugbaru, Garbaru, and Gabrias. He was actually the Roman general of Cyrus' armies. And that's who they believe he is. And it talks in verse 2 about how Daniel understood by the books the number of the years whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolation of Jerusalem. Daniel knew that Isaiah taught that Cyrus was anxious with prudence. Now we've got to a stage where the Persians have taken the city of Babylon. According to archaeologists, they took it on the 4th of October in 539 BC. Daniel thought that when this happened, that the Jews would immediately be released. They weren't. So what's going on? Then he reads from the book of Jeremiah, and he finds out that he says that they would be there for 70 years. 70 years is 70 years of 360 days a year, because the Bible and the Babylonians both use the 360-day calendar. It works out almost exactly the same amount of time as 69 years work out in our calendar. And it goes from 605 to 536 BC. At this stage, Daniel understood why they still hadn't come out. The 70 years hadn't yet run. The reason why they were going to spend 70 years there was because, according to Leviticus 26, if they didn't keep the Sabbath, eventually God would lead them into captivity, and then the land was bound to keep the Sabbath. They had to keep the Sabbath every 7 years. They had to keep what was called a sabbatical year. They never kept it for 490 years, so they owed God 70 Sabbaths. So you have this figure of 70, 7, and 490. Jesus uses exactly the same figure in Matthew 18 when he talks about forgiving. He said, "Don't forgive people 7 times, forgive them 70 times 7 times. God forgave Israel 490 times. Therefore, we should forgive people at least as many times as God does. After all, he's perfect and we're not. So this gives him the idea of 7, 70 and 490. And an angelic being appears before him and starts telling him about another 490 years that's going to happen in the future. And this 490 years prophecy has caused more provocation amongst Christians than any other prophecy in the Old Testament. The reason why is a lot of people know a lot about the Bible, but unfortunately they don't seem to know much about mathematics. Mathematics was always my pet subject when I was at school. I wasn't any good at anything else, but I was good at maths. In a series of mental arithmetics, I once scored 224 out of 225. I still wanted to say what the one question was that I got wrong. Nobody else in the class reached even 200. So it's my pet subject. Now, one of the keys to understanding this passage is to look at verse 25. Where it says this: "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem until the Messiah the Prince, will be 7 weeks and 2 weeks, meaning 69 weeks. The Hebrew word sabu'im means sevens, it does not mean weeks. It's the same with the Greek word hepted, means sevens. He's talking about periods of 7 years. 69 times 7 years equals 483 years. You have to change that into our calendar. In our calendar, it equals 476 years, and I made it 21 days, Thomas Ice made it 29. So we'll split the difference and make it 25. Now, the decree that led to the building up of the walls was the decree that Artaxerxes' longer maintenance made. He found that Nehemiah was very unhappy because he had heard that the walls had come down. We know from Jeremiah 39, verse 8, that the Babylonians brought them down. The palace was burnt, and 142 years later, it still hasn't been mended. That's why he produced this decree, that Nehemiah would go there and mend the walls. He did, and it took them 52 days to put the walls back up. If you add 476 years onto 444, which is the year of this decree, you might think you get 32 AD, but the year after 1 BC was 1 AD. So you have to add a year to it. That gives you the year 33 AD. Now, what about the days? All we know from Nehemiah 2 verse 1 is that it happened in the month of Nisan. It doesn't tell us what days, so we can't work it out precisely. The month of Nisan equates to our March. If you add 25 days onto March, you will either end up in the end of March or in the first 3 weeks of April. Therefore, Jesus must have been crucified sometime at the end of March or sometime in April of the year 33 AD. The likelihood that this viewpoint is wrong and it would still work out is about 2,500 to 3,000 to 1 against. So does it work out? The answer is yes, it does work out. First of all, he would have died on the 14th of Nisan, the day of the Passover. When was the 14th of Nisan? First of all, was it on a Friday in 33 AD? Yes, it was. Secondly, did he die in the March-April period of time? Yes. That year it was on the 2nd of April. Crucifixion, therefore, must have happened on the 2nd of April in the year 33 AD. Is this consistent with what the Gospel writers teach? Yes, it is. Turn to Luke 3, verse 1. Reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee. The 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, when was that? There's a man called Harold Hoffner who has examined well over 100 articles that give the date of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. Every single one of them say it was 15 AD. Now, people who believe in an earlier crucifixion try to claim that the viewpoint is that he became co-regent in 12 AD and therefore the 15th year is 26 AD. Luke would never have disagreed with all those historians. Everybody who writes about Luke writes that he was a very accurate historian. If you disagreed with all these Greek and Roman historians who were most of the people who recorded this history, and Luke's gospel was aimed at the Greeks, they would have immediately said, this guy doesn't know his history, and they would have immediately discredited him. He has to stick with the accurate information. Now, Arnold Fruchtenbaum believes that there's another viewpoint. He freed the myths. This is a very good explanation. But he also claims there's another explanation, that the 70 years started in 539 with the decree of Cyrus. Well, if it started 95 years before the other view, then the crucifixion also has to happen 95 years earlier, giving us a crucifixion date of 63 BC. I've never yet met a serious Bible theologian or historian who thought that 63 BC was the year of the crucifixion. So how does Arnold explain it? Well, it's quite simple. He doesn't. I've listened to him on this subject about 6 different times. 9 months ago on YouTube, he again talked about this subject. And he did exactly the same thing as he does every time. He explains after Erkut's long maintenance view and how it all works out mathematically. And then he goes to the other view and says, I won't go into the mathematics of it. Why not? If you believe this is a valid view, then prove it from the mathematics. Well, it's quite simple. You can't prove it from the mathematics. He's also said that the Persians' dating is very shaky, and therefore until they sort out their dating systems, you can't prove anything. You don't need to. You didn't prove the other view from Persian dating, you proved it from Roman dating. Nobody has ever suggested that the Roman dating is wrong. If you try to prove it from the Roman dating, you've got a lot of explaining to do because you're nearly a century in time out. Now, having talked about this, he then jumps and talks about the 70 of seven. And the 70 of seven is fulfilled by the Great Tribulation. Now, why is it that he goes from talking about the death of Christ and then there's this massive time gap to the Great Tribulation in the 70 times 7? The reason why is that the gap is fulfilled by the church age. As soon as Christ dies, the church age starts almost immediately. And in the Old Testament, according to Ephesians 3, the church age was a mystery. The word mystery doesn't mean unexplained. It means to reveal something that is now being revealed. That's what it meant in Greek at that time. So that's why you get this jump in time. And the prophetic clock time doesn't continue until the church has been removed. This is one reason why the pre-trib rapture view must be right, because it can only continue when the church has been removed. All the time the church is here, the 77s cannot be fulfilled. Okay, so let's go back to the book of Daniel, chapter 9. And it tells us in verse 27, he, that is the prince who should come in the previous verse, the Antichrist, shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the middle of the week, after 3.5 years, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. He breaks the covenant. And in Isaiah 28, it actually talks about this. And it compares it with a covenant that Hezekiah is thinking of making with the Assyrian army. And the word of the Lord from Isaiah is, don't make this covenant with them. So he didn't, and the Assyrians came against them in 701 BC and surrounded the city of Jerusalem. But Isaiah told Hezekiah not to fear. And one night they got up to find out that during the night the entire Assyrian army had died. This is also confirmed by the Greek historian Herodotus, who tells us that in one night the Assyrian army were all wiped out by the bubonic plague, most deadly form ever known to us when it comes to illnesses, the infamous Black Death. Right, if you go over now to Daniel 11, verse 45, he's broken the covenant, and by this time, 14 judgments have come down from God. We're now just approaching the mid-trib stage of the tribulation, and 7 seal judgments, followed by 7 trumpet judgments, have all happened. And by this time, the Antichrist has just broken his covenant with the Jews. What does he do? He has the cheek to turn up in Israel, despite this, what bravado. And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas, that would be the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea, in the glorious holy mountain, that would be Mount Zion. Yet he shall come to an end, and none shall help him. Nobody would be able to help him. We're actually told in the book of Revelation that he dies of a fatal wound, Revelation 13, verse 3, or a deadly wound. Since it happened in Israel, and since the Jews are well and truly ticked off with him, no doubt ticked off at another Gentile leader who can't keep his promises to the Jews, just like Britain and America haven't kept their promises to the Jews, and have now given away 87% of the land originally promised to them under the Balfour Declaration of 1917. So I suspect they will be really ticked off with this guy. And I suspect that somebody, probably a Jewish assassin, will get a rifle out and put a bullet through his brain. Hezekiah has some words to say about this covenant. He calls it a covenant with Sheol, or death. And he says, the bed is too short. I was once at a Christian conference where I was rooming with a couple of other guys, and one of the guys was about 6'4" tall, and every morning I'd wake up and see that this guy's feet were hanging out at the end of the bed, which I thought was quite amusing. You see, what it means is it's insufficient for good news. It is, because it's unreliable. He's going to break it. He can't be trusted. Okay, let's go to Revelation 11, verse 1 now. And there was given a reed like a rod, a reed is a measuring instrument. And the angel stood saying, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and then that worship therein. But the court which is without, the temple leave out and measure it not. For it is given unto the Gentiles, not the Jews, but the Gentiles. And the holy city, Jerusalem, shall be trodden underfoot 42 months. This tells us one or two things here. First of all, there are still 42 months of the Great Tribulation to go, which placed it in the middle of the Great Tribulation. Secondly, it means that the third Jewish temple is now up. So by the middle of the Great Tribulation, the Jewish temple must be operational. Okay, if you go to verse 6, talking about the two witnesses that are going to be. They had power to shut up heaven, that it rained not in the days of their prophecy. They actually are operational during the first half of the Great Tribulation. And they have power over waters to turn them to blood and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will. This has led many people to say that this is Moses and Elijah come back, as if Moses and Elijah are the only people who could possibly have done this. Most Bible theologians believe they are two people who live in the end times, and that they have the same power as Moses and Elijah. Elijah is actually going to be around at the end of the Great Tribulation, because according to the prophet, according to the book of Malachi, Elijah is still going to be around when Jewish unity is restored. And Jewish unity being restored, according to the prophet Hosea, happens 3 days from the end of the Great Tribulation. So he must still be around. According to this passage, this guy's going to be killed in the middle of the Great Tribulation and ascended to heaven. So I think these are just two people who live at that time. And when they had finished their testimony, the beast that cometh out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them and shall overcome them and kill them. The bottomless pit is one of four sections in the place known as Sheol or Hades in the Bible. It's the same place as the abyss, and it's also called the deep in the Bible. The other three places are called Tartarus, Abraham's bosom, which is where Old Testament saints used to go, it's where Jesus would descend in. And the other place is a section of torment that we in the Western world today refer to as hell. Don't confuse this place with the lake of fire. The lake of fire is Gehenna. And as we shall see when we get to Revelation 20, they cannot possibly be the same place. Okay, so there's four places. Now the fact that he goes to the abyss shows he's not a proper human being. Because if he were, he would go to hell. So what is he? In Genesis 6, verses 1 to 5, it tells us about something similar that's going to happen. And many people don't understand this passage. And if you go on the internet, you get lots of people come up with explanations that simply aren't correct. Verse 1, and it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God, the B'nai Ha Elohim, a name for angelic beings, were born unto them. So daughters were actually being born unto these angelic beings. What they were doing was they were impregnating real human women. And they were producing a group of human beings known as the Gibberim. Notice in verse 4 it says there were giants on the land. In the Hebrew it says Nephilim. Nephilim in Hebrew means fallen ones. The fallen ones are the fallen angels. So they bore them children and they produced this incredible race of children. The word mighty in the text means is Gibberim in Hebrew. And it's used about Jesus. In Isaiah 9 verse 6 it's called him the mighty God, the El Gibor. So it means extreme might. And they produced this evil race because their fathers were demonic spirits. And they were the worst, most powerful human beings ever to come upon the earth. And that's why God had to do something about it very quickly. And he produced a flood that would wipe out all the Gibberim children. And also he took the angelic beings that were demonic and put them in this place called Tartarus. And according to Jude, they are reserved in everlasting chains. Peter also talks about this. He actually calls the place Tartarus. Okay. So he kills the two witnesses. In Revelation 12, he starts off by telling you about dragon. The dragon in the book of Revelation is Satan. If you read verse 9, you'll find it tells you that. He also tells you that at the start of Revelation chapter 20. He also spends an immense amount of time in the abyss. Okay, now in this passage, I'm just going to summarise what it says. It tells you that there's also a woman. The woman has 12 signs around her head, or 12 stars around her head. When you use symbolism in the book of Revelation, you have to look for where it was previously used in the Bible. That symbolism was previously used in Joseph's dream in Genesis 37. And it represented his mother, his father, and his 11 brothers. He should have been 12, but he wasn't included. He wasn't going to bow down to himself. So the 12 stars represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And Satan is kicked out of heaven for the final time. Angelic beings do go to heaven occasionally and present themselves before God. And they tell God what they've been doing. Satan does that in the book of Job. Well, you've been doing it. Going around all the earth trying to drum up support. And according to me, everybody's now on my side. That's what he told God. And God said, no, they're not. Job isn't for a start. That's when Job's problems already occurred. So they run after the woman. But in order to run after the woman, Satan needs a body. And the body that he would use would be the body of the Antichrist. But let's see what it says about the woman in verse 14. And the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place. But she's going to be nourished for a time, that's 1 year, times, which is 2 years, and half a time, 3.5 years, from the face of the serpent. Certain people in America says the great eagle represents the United States, and it means the United States are going to help the Israelis at this time. Well, this same term is also used in the book of Exodus. And if you're going to be consistent to that interpretation, it means that the Israelis got out of Egypt all those thousands of years ago because the US Army or the Airmen helped them. They didn't. What it really means is that they come out with great speed and protection. The eagle is known to be a very protective bird of its young. When they come out, they are capable of swooping at 175 miles an hour. They normally go 150, but when they see something that can also go 150, they get above it, and then they swoop down, increase their speed to 175, and they catch the thing that they're trying to catch. We know from Jeremiah 31, verse 2, that the Jews at this time find grace in the wilderness, and the wilderness that they go into is the wilderness of Bozrah. Bozrah, which is in Edom. And when we look at the second coming, we will see that Jesus originally goes to Bozrah in Edom in order to save them. Okay, well, the next thing that happens after this is the abomination, the desolation. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 1 to 5. This is spoken about three times in the book of Daniel. Once it's talking about a man called Antiochus Epiphanes, the other two times it's talking about the Antichrist. Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that you be soon shaken in mind and troubled, not by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter from us, at the day of the Lord, it should say, they're not Christ, is at hand. The day of the Lord is a term for the great tribulation. Let no man deceive you by any means, that day shall come, except there come a falling away first, and the man of sin, who turns out to be the Antichrist, shall be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, that is worship, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. This is what's called the abomination, the desolation. It's actually two things. One of the things it is the Antichrist coming up to the temple and being worshipped as God. The second thing is that he erects an altar at a later stage, and he also puts that in the temple. Those are the two things that represent the abomination and desolation. This is going to happen, and this is the time when, according to Matthew's Gospel, the Jews should get out of Jerusalem. Matthew 24:15. When you see the sign of the abomination standing where it ought not in the Jewish temple, that is the time to flee. And that's what causes them to flee from the Antichrist. They see that happening, they know it's time to get out, and they do flee. And the Bible teaches that the earth swallows them up. Somebody said to me, that sounds like an earthquake. No, God isn't going to swallow them up by an earthquake when they're fleeing from the Antichrist. What it means is that they just disappear from view. It's like they've magically disappeared. So anyone following them is going to say, where did they go to? And because they don't know their Bibles well enough, they won't know that they've gone to Petra in Jordan. There's three questions that are asked in Matthew 24:3. One is, when is the temple going to be destroyed? Only Luke answers this question. When you see the armies gathering around Jerusalem, know that a desolation is near. The armies gathered around Jerusalem in 67 AD, a commander called Cestus Gallus. But when his food lines were cut, he decided to retreat to get more food. And the Sicarii, the most extreme form of the Zealot movement, they were called the Dagger Men, killed him. The Romans never came back to 69 AD. By then, Vespasian was the emperor, and his son Titus was in charge of his army. They basically did the same thing as the Babylonians had done several centuries before. They starved them out of the city. In the end, they were so hungry they were eating their own children. That's how hungry they were. But they starved them out eventually. The second thing is, what is the sign of your coming? The sign of your coming is the desolation and abomination. And he tells us that in chapter 24:15. What is the sign of the end of the age? The sign of the end of the age is the Son of Man actually appearing in the cloud of heaven, the Shekinah glory. When they see the Shekinah glory and they see the cloud, and they see the great light that emanates from that cloud, that is when they know the end of the age has come. The new age is about to come in. And after 75 days, during which Jesus is going to do various different things, we'll look at what they are at a later study. Then the new age will come in, and that's called the Millennial Kingdom. It will last for 1,000 years. Okay, if you go on to chapter 13:1. Look at Revelation, I should say. You have trouble finding chapter 13:1 in Daniel, because there's only 12 chapters. And I stood upon the stand of the sea, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns were 10 crowns, and upon the heads of the name of blasphemy. The beast that he's talking about is the Antichrist. He starts to read about how he talks about boasting, great things. Other books like Daniel 7 also talk about him doing the same things. He's a great boaster, he blasphemes even against the God of heaven. Now, when the Bible uses symbolisms, it always uses them consistently, and the sea is a symbol of the Gentile nations. This passage tells us that the Antichrist will be a Gentile. But there's another passage that's far more specific than this, and that's if you go back to Daniel 9:27. Or 26, it actually is. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, die. But not for himself. He wasn't cut off for himself. He was cut for the sins of other people. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The prince that shall come is the Antichrist. The people of the prince that shall come, the people who destroyed the city and the sanctuary, were the Romans. Rome destroyed that. That means he would be of Roman descent. However, this has led to a lot of discussion again. Who are people of Roman descent? If you've read the book Left Behind series, Tim LaHaye makes the Antichrist a Romanian in that particular book. The Romanians were part of the Roman Empire. Everywhere the Romans went, a certain amount of them stayed there. And therefore, everywhere they went, a certain amount of them became of Romanic descent. Romania was conquered by Rome in 106 AD. The Dacians, they were called at that time. Therefore, there would be Romanians today of Romanic descent. There are even British people of Romanic descent, and the Romans even conquered places like Libya. So, we're left with quite a bit of room for error. Now, something that a lot of people believe is that the Italians were Romans. The Romans and Italians were completely different people, as were the British. They're all three of them are what we call a mishmash, or a mixture, if you study back into our history. So I thought I'd tell you for a few minutes about the Romans. First of all, Rome was originally created in 753 BC, and they immediately set up a Senate. However, the Senate did not rule over them. A group of people from Troy called the Etruscans ruled over them. They ruled over them through seven kings. They became known as the Tarquin kings. But the only reason why I can work out they were called the Tarquin kings is because two of them were called Tarquin. The fifth one was called Tarquin the First, and the seventh one was called by the wonderful name of Lucius Tarquinius Superbus, which really amazed me because I didn't know they had buses in 509 BC. That's when they rebelled, just as the Egyptians eventually rebelled against the Hyksos rule. That's when all the Israelites' problems started in the book of Exodus. So these people rebelled against the Tarquin kings. And Rome from that point on became a republic. They had elections every single year, and they voted two people into office, who they called consuls, also called magistrates. If you read the book of Acts in chapter 16, you'll find they went to Philippi, and it talks about magistrates in Philippi. Philippi was a colony of Rome. The Republic continued until 49 AD when Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon. At that stage they changed and they became triumvirates. Tri is a Latin prefix for three. Triangle, three sides, tricycle, three wheels, and trinity or trinity, three persons in the Godhead. People often call him Julius Caesar. He was never Caesar. He was a triumvirate. He was assassinated in 44 BC, and the first Caesar of Rome was Octavian, who became better known as Augustus in 27 BC. The other two triumvirates were Crassus, Cinna's Spartacus, he actually appears in that as one of the Roman generals, and Pompey. They also introduced imperialism at that time, where they actually invaded places that actually had their own people in charge. Pontius Pilate was in charge of Israel. In the 3rd and 4th centuries, they had many wars with the Italians, and they defeated them again and again. And in 396 AD, Italy became part of the Roman Empire. But the Roman Empire was by then in serious decay. In 410 AD, one of the Germanic bands, called the Goths, actually sacked the city of Rome itself. Aurelius Augustine, who was a bishop of Hippo in Numidia, very famous man, did some very famous writings, and he thought the world was coming to an end at that time. 476, the Roman Empire completely collapsed. In 493, Italy started to have kings. And one of the things that the Romans had vowed was that they would never, ever have a king again to rule after the Tarquin kings had reigned. They said, that's the end, we would refuse to have kings. They would never become part of the Italian nation. So when did Rome become part of the Italian nation? On the 17th of May, 1861. The Italian nation decided at that stage to become what's called a solitary state. And as a result, there was a unification between Rome, Italy and Sicily. Eventually, in 1946, they decided to do away with the monarchy completely. And Umberto II was the last king to rule. So that's what they did. They would never allow Rome to be a part of the Italian nation. But when they became a solitary state, it meant that they voted for people to be in charge. Well, that's what Rome did with their republic. So basically, they took on the same form as Rome had taken on 2,500 years earlier. And when they did that, they were willing to unify with Italy. So that's what actually happened. So the Antichrist will be Roman, and he has to be Roman, because he is the iron feet in Daniel's dream. If you look at Daniel's dream, as it goes down the body, it goes down through the passage of time and ends up with the feet in clay. And the 10 toes of clay are the 10 kings who had originally ruled with the Antichrist in the second half of the tribulation. But like clay, they are weak. And like iron, the Antichrist is strong. And that's why ultimately he will end up with all the authority and he will tell them what to do. And that's it for today.